Hello there, and welcome to Endeavors, coming to you from wherever you are, wherever you have been, or wherever you may be headed. Of course, we're coming at you from terrestrial radio on CJSF 90.1 FM, also CHSRCFMHCICVCKDU, The Scope at Ryerson, and Caper Radio Cape Breton. Thank you, as always, for supporting the show. And it's a big show today. For you pedantic policy wonks, we've got something special for you today. I have a extended interview with economist Jeff Rubin, whose new book, The Carbon Bubble, basically dismantles Stephen Harper's energy policy and talks about pipelines and the Alberta oil sands and why that is bad, not only environmentally, but financially and economically as well. If economics aren't really your thing, we also have a little bit of entertainment, old school style. I got to chat with actor, singer, and former Hollywood golden boy, the legend, Tab Hunter. He is the focus of a new documentary, Tab Hunter Confidential, just released this past month, which was based in turn off his memoir of the same name. And on the music front today, we have the great band No Joy, and I spoke with No Joy singer Jasmine White Glues on the show, and we're going to start off today with a song off their new album, More Faithful. This is Hollywood Teeth. Jasmine White Glutes of No Joy, and you'll be hearing from her a little later on in the program. But right now, my first guest is the author of Why Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller, which was a national bestseller, and the winner of the National Business Book Award. And his second book, The End of Growth, was also a number one bestseller and made multiple Best Book of the Year lists in 2012. He was the chief economist at CIBC World Markets, where he worked for over 20 years. In his new book, the carbon bubble, what happens to us when it bursts. He addresses Canada's national economic future and the financial security of all Canadians. Since 2006 and the election of the first Harper government, the vision of Canada's future as an energy superpower has driven the political agenda, as well as the fast-paced development of Alberta's oil sands and the push for more pipelines across the country to bring bitumen to the market. Anyone who objects is labeled a dreamer or worse, an environmentalist. He is Jeff Rubin, and I spoke with him on Monday. I'm here with Jeff Rubin. Jeff, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So, the carbon bubble, what happens to us when it bursts? When did you first start to notice that something was awry with the Prime Minister's policy and approach when it comes to energy?
Well, I guess at any time that you consider that there is going to be a constraint on how much we can emit, because the minute you recognize that, you realize the implications for the oil sands. And as you know, the Prime Minister has identified the oil sands as sort of the engine, not just of Alberta's economic growth, but the whole country's economic growth, and claims all these linkages to other provinces. And the problem, of course, being not only that the oil sands is a dirty form of oil, a more emission-intensive source of oil, but way more importantly, the oil sands is one of the high-cost sources of oil in the world, and high-cost sources of oil require very high oil prices, and high oil prices require very strong world demand, and that flies in the face of everything the scientific community has told us about carbon emissions, and not just the scientific community, the International Energy Agency, which is probably the most authoritative source on energy modeling, has actually taken the scientific community's 450 parts per million world and modeled what that implies for future coal demand, future oil demand, future natural gas demand. And they're very different demand projections than you would find in the business plans of Suncor or Exxon, which is just business as usual and continuing very strong growth in world oil demand. Coal would, by 2035, have to be like 33% lower than today. Oil would probably be around 80 million barrels a day versus 92. So that's a very different world than the world that the Prime Minister and the oil sand companies have been telling their investors.
We talked about, you mentioned high oil prices, and a few months ago here in Vancouver and many parts across the country, it shot down to a dollar, near a dollar, and now it's back up to $1.30 again. Is that indicative of just how fragile that industry is, that the prices can fluctuate that dramatically in such a short span of time?
Well, it indicates perhaps how delinked gasoline prices have become from oil prices, because certainly there has been a disconnect, and that goes down to the retail level. But I think the picture for investors, for example, has been very clear that the oil sector has been one of the biggest dogs in the Toronto Stock Exchange. And you know, for people who say, "Well, I don't own any Suncor or Canadian Natural Resources or Canadian Oil Sands. I just own the index." Well, guess what? When you own the TSX index, as most people do, you own a lot of carbon, and also the most expensive carbon, and hence the most vulnerable carbon resources to a world of restrained demand.
So that brings up the issue of a carbon tax.
Yes.
It was tried here in BC, and it was vehemently opposed. Is that something that is a realistic realistic position to put governments in?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, it was maybe vehemently opposed, but it's been running for now 6 or 7 years, and it's done what it was intended to do, which is to get people to fill up less at the pumps. Gasoline consumption, diesel consumption has actually fallen in British Columbia, where it's risen in the rest of the country. Now, it adds roughly another 7 cents a liter to the pump prices that you were just quoting me, but it's also offset by cuts in personal income tax. Prime Minister Harper would call carbon taxes a job killer, but if they're accompanied by personal income taxes, they're the contrary. They're a job creator, because to the extent that you spend less at the pumps, the personal income tax cut gives you more money to spend on everything else. And as I say, that's a job creator, not a job killer. Maybe not a job creator in Fort McMurray, but a job creator for the rest of the economy.
That brings up the issue of public transit. We just had a big referendum here about whether or not to build more public transit. They wanted to increase the GST by 0.05% in order to pay for this expansion of public transit. How would something like that, spending several million dollars on public transit, affect oil and gas prices, if at all?
Oil's last stand is on the road. By that I mean that we've replaced oil as a source of power generation or as a home heating fuel. But what we haven't done is really replaced oil as a transit fuel. And over 70% of all the oil consumed is consumed in that form. So public transit, by discouraging us to drive our individual cars, is hitting oil where oil is the most vulnerable. I'm not sure that I would advocate increasing, you know, the GST to pay for that. The carbon tax that was initially introduced here at $30 a ton was supposed to be raised every year, and Premier Clark has backed off that. I'd rather see carbon taxes pay for public transit, and while $30 a ton is a good start, you know, we're going to have to pay much, much higher carbon taxes in the future if the tax system is going to play a positive role in decarbonizing our economy, as I think it must.
So a huge issue here in Vancouver, being around the coast, is, of course, pipelines.
Yes.
Both the one from Alberta to here and then the one that goes from Kitimat, proposing to go to Kitimat all the way down to the States. Now, I've been to a couple of the protests, the discussions, whatever you want to call them. And it goes back to what you said about job creators. A lot of the pro-pipeline people will say that they create jobs. But break it down why you think that isn't necessarily true in the long run.
Well, not only do I think it's not necessarily true in the long run, but I don't think those pipelines are going to get built, because those pipelines no longer have an economic context. Of course, they're going to be approved by the National Energy Board. When has the National Energy Board ever not approved a pipeline? But National Energy Board approval, while necessary, is not a sufficient condition. And if you step back and, you know, realize why these pipelines are being built, these pipelines are being built to facilitate the doubling of production from the oil sands. But if you look at where oil prices are today and its impact on oil sand projects, there is going to be no doubling. Okay, like every week when you hear that the Jocelyn mine has been canceled, the Bear River mine has been canceled, these were the very projects that were going to double oil sand production. Without that big increase in production, we don't need Keystone XL, we don't need Energy East, we don't need Northern Gateway or a twinning of the Trans Mountain pipeline. And in short, the pipelines have lost their economic context.
I think what a lot of people don't understand when it comes to pipeline is bitumen, the type of product that flows through the pipelines, especially from the oil sands. Can you explain a little bit what bitumen is and how it maybe differs from your more traditional?
Okay, well, you know, bitumen has, you know, at room temperature the consistency of a hockey puck. So bitumen doesn't flow through pipelines on its own. You have to use diluent, okay, which is a natural gas liquid, so that it actually is viscous enough to move through a pipeline. That's why the pipelines have to have a capacity much greater than just what the bitumen flow is going to be because it has to be diluted. But again, I say that these pipelines no longer have an economic context because at today's oil prices, you're not going to see any expansion in oil sand productions, not because of environmental regulations, but simply that it's virtually impossible to get financial markets to finance those kinds of increases.
I met a rail commander last year, and he says that between trains and pipelines, pipelines may be the safer option, and he pointed to Lac Mégantic as a perfect example of that. So, you know, given that we have those two main methods of transporting oil and gas right now, what are your thoughts on
Well,
that?
I mean, all of a sudden, trains have become pipelines on wheels. And we've seen an exponential rise in rail oil traffic on both sides of the border. In fact, oil shipments have been the greatest source of revenue growth for railways. You know, ironically, at a time when their biggest customer, coal, another hydrocarbon, has gone the other way. And, you know, we've seen Lac Mégantic, that tragedy. I mean, when people don't realize that how many .111 tanker cars go through Chicago or Toronto every day, and that's the real danger there. But just as pipelines no longer have an economic context, neither do rail cars. And we're seeing that. Like, people were projecting these massive increase in rail shipments. Now you're seeing that plateau and probably decline because, again, they were there to facilitate the increase in production, and that increase in production looks increasingly doubtful.
One of the other aspects you bring up in the book is fracking.
Yes.
Fracturing, and Christy Clark has said she's a fan of fracking to a certain extent. But in my opinion, it seems to be far worse than oil, gas, and coal production because of how it's done and
that's right.
The damage it does to the environment. What is so bad about hydraulic fracturing?
Okay, well, first let's talk about the economic damage that fracking has done to the oil sands. Because, you know, the whole doubling of production wasn't so people in Lethbridge or Moose Jaw could fill up. I mean, Canada already produces over double what it consumes. So this was all going to be for the export market. And the export market, the intended export market, was going to be to the United States. And at one time, the U.S. was looking forward to Canadian oil sands because they didn't want to be relying on Venezuelan oil or Middle East oil. However, the fracking revolution changed that. All of a sudden, U.S. oil production virtually doubled. Places like the Bakken in North Dakota that no one had ever heard of is now producing over 1 million barrels. Eagle Ford, the Permian Basin in Texas. So it's left high-cost Canadian oil sand the odd man out. And hence the need now to find pipelines to the coast, whether it be on the Pacific coast or the Atlantic coast, to ship to other markets. The environmental issue with fracking, natural gas has been called a clean fuel because it has per unit of energy half the emissions of, say, coal. But with fracking, that's no longer the case. And fracking, shale gas, is where all the big increases in gas supply have come from. Among other things, the fugitive methane emissions that come from fracking make it highly debatable whether frack nat gas, is any cleaner than coal at all. There are, of course, other environmental problems, groundwater contamination. Once you frack, and it's very water intensive, you can't use that water for anything else. At best, you might be able to reclaim it to continue fracking, but it's not like you can all of a sudden water your crops with this, because it's a toxic cocktail of chemicals that are involved in the fracking process. In addition, fracking has induced seismic activity. And if you look at places like Oklahoma and Texas, where fracking for both oil and gas is very common, there have now been lots of documentation on induced earthquake activity. So there are a lot of environmental issues on fracking. Taking it over to BC, BC's gas plays, its dreams of building LNG terminals, most of that gas that would supply those LNG terminals are actually shale gas from the province's interior, and that would be accessible only through fracking. And all of the problems associated with fracking of oil are associated with fracking of gas, and in particular, even more so on the gas side because of the fugitive methane emissions.
You mentioned how gas was known as a clean fuel, and I know when Obama was first running for office in 2008, the phrase clean coal came up a lot, which to me always seemed like a misnomer because coal inherently isn't clean.
Yeah. The only way that you can make coal clean in an emission sense is to capture and sequester the emissions. There's one project in Saskatchewan that does that. But in order for that to be economically viable, there has to be a very significant price on carbon emissions. Otherwise, it just doesn't make any economic sense to do this. The kind of prices needed to incent commercial players to capture and sequester CO2 from coal plants is around $100 a ton. Okay, to put that in context, BC's carbon tax is $30 a ton, and that's the most expensive price for carbon anywhere in the country. So we can't really expect to see clean coal in the sense of capturing coal's emissions without carbon prices that are at least three times what they are in British Columbia.
So how would you rate overall Obama's record on energy and sustainability, especially when put up against Stephen Harper?
Well, Obama's been very opportunistic. It's true that he's raised the levels for emissions on new power plants that effectively preclude new coal fire plants from being built. But he's only done that because of the shale gas revolution. So that in the past, if you prevented coal plants from being built, it meant higher power costs for U.S. utility consumers. Now it doesn't, because coal's now all of a sudden more expensive than that gas. So, you know, I mean, yes, it's good that the legislation now prevents new coal fire plants from being built, but it's noteworthy that he only did that after the shale gas revolution. Harper, I think, Harper's has not only failed to follow Obama on the emissions side, but Harper's defined one of the dirtiest hydrocarbons and one of the most expensive, and I want to emphasize the most expensive because I think that's a more lethal liability to the oil sands, as the engine of economic growth. So, I mean, you know, he's basically, to put it in finance terms, doubling down on a resource that the rest of the world is short.
So let's talk about alternatives. There's sort of, I guess, three or four main alternatives that people are proposing.
Right.
We've got hydroelectric, nuclear, solar, and wind. And it seems right now that solar and wind might have the edge over the other two.
Well, I would say up until Fukushima, that nuclear power was probably our best bet at replacing oil. How nuclear power would replace oil would be that nuclear power would create electric power, and that's what you would plug your car battery into. After Fukushima, I think the goalposts have moved. Fukushima is probably going to turn out to be the worst nuclear disaster, even worse than Chernobyl. With the exception of South Korea, China, and India, nobody is building nuclear power plants anymore. And even traditional nuclear power places like France and Germany have declared that they are going to be weaning themselves off nuclear power. Solar and wind, they're there. They're still more expensive than the alternatives. Probably we need to see some transformative event in battery technology that will move the goalposts. Let me point out that technology is not just a random process, that it's shaped by economic conditions. The more that we put a price on carbon emissions, the more we incent the development of alternative technologies. So, you know, I think there's a direct link to how aggressive we are on carbon emissions and the speed at which technical change will create other opportunities in either wind, solar, or something yet to be determined.
I know that they're in Finland, they're building an underground nuclear waste facility. And if there was safety regulations, you know, really strict safety regulations put in place, could we see nuclear energy make a comeback?
We might, but I think more likely we're going to see the price of solar fall. And that's going to become the more attractive option. And solar raises all kinds of interesting possibilities because, you know, you can't have your own nuclear reactor in your home or your own coal fire plant in your home, but you can have your own solar panels. And if you can, you can disconnect from the grid. And that's going to be a challenge for all the major utility companies. For example, in the province where I live, Ontario, they're going to be privatizing the transmission company. Sounds like, you know, like an attractive prospect to many people, but if in fact solar starts to take root and becomes a major source of power generation, it may not be such a great investment as more and more households actually disconnect from the grid.
So are you saying that we need to make our energy sector more public then, as opposed to privatization of it?
Or I'm just saying more diversified. We've, as I say, put all of our eggs in the hydrocarbon basket, and not just the hydrocarbon basket, but the most expensive oil to produce in the world. So, you know, I think we've really got to shift emphasis. I think certainly hydroelectric power becomes a lot more valuable and a lot more sought after in a world of constrained emissions. And maybe, you know, part of the solution is just to consume less power. And let me just give you a little story that I mentioned in my last book, The End of Growth. Take Copenhagen in Denmark, and they're usually seen as a poster book example of a country that has lowered its emissions below 1990 standards. Actually, while you think about windmills, when you land in Copenhagen, the island surrounded by windmills, 80% of the power in Denmark comes from coal. So you may wonder, how is it that Denmark has been successful at lowering its emissions when 80% of its power comes from coal? I mean, that's as great, if not greater, than China's reliance on coal. And the answer is that whether the kilowatt of power comes from coal or comes from wind, it's 30 cents a kilowatt. Effectively because of carbon taxes, okay? So at 30 cents a kilowatt, guess what? People turn off the lights. And if you would compare electricity consumption in Copenhagen with my city, Toronto, you know, it's about one-third of what an average Toronto home would consume. And you don't see, you know, thousands of people in Copenhagen lining up at the Canadian Embassy or the U.S. Embassy to immigrate to cheap coal power places like Montana or Alberta. In fact, you know, Denmark has one of the highest qualities of life. So I think the lesson here is, you know, you don't necessarily have to have wind power. If we charge 30 cents per kilowatt hour, guess what? We would see electricity demand decline. And certainly that's got to be part of the solution, that we've got to start pricing not just the cost of extracting coal and oil and nat gas, but the cost of emitting that. And when we do, we will get those prices and we will get that adjustment in demand. And it doesn't mean going back to the Stone Age, because actually Denmark's a quite attractive place to be.
Well, the book is The Carbon Bubble, What Happens to Us When It Bursts, by Jeff Rubin. Jeff Rubin, thank you so much for the conversation today.
My pleasure. Take care.
Started fashioning, and now we
was Corporal Demon by No Joy off the album More Faithful. And Jasmine White Glues is one half of this Montreal-based shoegaze band, and More Faithful is their third full-length record following Ghost Blonde and Wait to Pleasure. And I had a chance to speak with Jasmine about the record last week. Jasmine White Gloss, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, No Joy's new album is More Faithful. It was just released this week. How did this project come about for you guys?
How did the record come about?
Yeah.
We had made another record and then toured it and then decided that we were going to make another one.
Seems to be the pretty standard pretty standard way to go.
Yeah.
How do you navigate yourselves as a band from record to record, album to album, in terms of the writing process and the musical direction that you want to take?
We were bored. We just wanted to challenge ourselves a little bit and try to write songs that were challenging for us to write and to play, and then just kind of went like in that direction.
I saw the trailer for the album, and I think I read on it somewhere that it said trippy fucking metal or something like that. Where did that come about?
That's just a joke. We're just playing.
Yeah, I like it. How would you describe your overall writing process? Do you take lyrics and then overlay them to the tracks, or do you always start with the instrumentation first?
It's always one of us has like a little demo that we bring in to the jam space or something, and then we kind of build on it. But lyrics are like the very last thing that ever gets put in.
Now I've heard you guys been described as shoegaze, and a lot of people might be sort of unfamiliar with that term. Do you agree with that designation, and how would you describe what that is?
I don't necessarily think we're a shoegaze band at all. But I don't care what people think it sounds like. That is fine.
Yeah.
and I don't know. It's the type of music.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was at the train.
Oh right, you're right at the train. Nice.
I'm right beside the train. People can hear whatever they want to hear. I don't care.
But I mean, like, do you think that emphasizes a bigger problem that, in music, we're always trying to label it something or other. We're always trying to call it this or that when we should just call it music.
Yeah, for sure. It's easier for people to review it or to whatever if there's like an easier a tag on it. Then, that's how it is at the record store. Sometimes you go by genre, so you have to be able to classify it somehow.
I know you guys, from what I read, you were living in LA, and Laura was living in Montreal, and you returned to Montreal. What was how would you describe the Montreal music scene out east when you first started? What was that like for you guys getting involved in that?
It's very small, so it's not like we were getting involved in it. It's just if you play music in Montreal, you pretty much are a degree away from everybody, so it's not like we try to get involved in a Montreal music scene. It's just we lived in Montreal.
How would you compare that scene to sort of the other cities across the country that you've been touring?
I don't even know really. We play Montreal way less than we do other cities that we're not from. So I don't really know I don't know what the Montreal scene is, and I don't really know what the scenes are
in
other cities either.
Yeah, fair enough. But what I mean, do you have any thoughts on the sort of the Canadian independent scene as a whole? Because the music industry has changed so much within the last 5 years.
I do know that now we're involved with arts and crafts, so we're happy to feel a little more Canadian. Because a lot of times people would just assume we were American because our label mentioned Summer was American and we toured the States so much. So we're happy now that we have a little bit of more of a home base with arts and crafts.
Would you say that you have a favorite song off of More Faithful?
No, they're all bad.
Okay. Well, the album is More Faithful, and thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
For many years, my next guest was the golden boy of Hollywood, appearing in such films as The Girl He Left Behind with Natalie Wood, the musical Damn Yankees with Gwen Verdon, The Man with Two Faces, even John Waters' Polyester, and Dark Horse, which he wrote the original story for and was the last time he appeared on screen. In the 1960s, he settled in the south of France and appeared in many spaghetti westerns. But he also had a secret for many years that went unacknowledged until 2007 when he released his memoir, Tab Hunter Confidential. Tab Hunter, one of the leading men of Hollywood in the 50s and 60s, was also gay. After being paired with such figures as Natalie Wood, he also dated other actors like Anthony Perkins, but kept quiet about it because if he came out, his career would be over. Well, there's a new documentary about his life, Tab Hunter Confidential, based on the aforementioned biography of the same name written by Hunter. It's a very interesting look at one of the kings of Hollywood in its golden age, and I had a chance to speak with the golden boy himself last week. Here's my conversation with Tab Hunter. Tab Hunter, thank you so much for joining me today.
You bet, thank you.
So the movie is Tab Hunter Confidential, and
correct.
I know it was originally a book, but how did this get turned into a movie? Was that always part of the plan?
Not really, no. In fact, Alan had to talk like crazy to talk me into doing the book, and he told me to do it because he said someone else is going to be doing it. I think you should get it out there before you drop dead. And, you know, because otherwise people put a spin on your life. So we did the book, and then he was working on me to do the documentary. And I said, oh, Alan, I don't think that's necessary. And he said, no, I want to do a documentary based on the book. So he met Jeffrey, our director, who has a nice reputation, is a good director and a very good editor, and they collaborated on the screen, on it, and it took Alan 6 years to put it together.
I mean, anybody can make a documentary about anybody. How important was it for you that your partner in life was the one behind this movie?
Well, I think it's wonderful for him because he's a very fine producer. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I really don't care about being in the public eye. I've had my shot at that years ago, and it was never my comfort zone. But Alan talked me into doing this after the book quite a few years after the book. And I just thought, well, you know, if it can help someone in some way, I think that's really, really important. Because I was a very shy young man. And, you know, it's through the journey through life that people help us. And I thought maybe it can mean something to someone in some capacity.
Let's talk about that for a bit, because you were sort of king, you know, the golden boy of Hollywood for many years when you were still quite young.
Well, there were a lot of golden boys of Hollywood. I just happened to be the one at Warner Brothers and independent prior to that. Yeah, you know, they labeled you, Hollywood labeled you this or labeled you that. In fact, people are so conscious of, guilty, I should say, of labeling people. And that's why, you know, I started my book with the first line, I hate labels. The important thing is, what kind of a human being are you? But Hollywood was a wonderful place for young people at that time, or anyone at that time. Unfortunately, it was the end of the studio system.
Well, I want to talk about that a bit, because a lot of people today, and, you know, fans and even a lot of young actors are unfamiliar with how that aspect of Hollywood worked. I understand you were contracted to Warner Brothers for, you know, 7 or 8 films at a time.
I was under contract to Warner's. I did a lot of tests for one role in a film, and then they signed me for it. And with the success of the film, they then exercised their option and put me under contract. It was at the end of the studio contract era. The studios were sort of falling apart then. You know, those wonderful moguls knew how to run their businesses, but they had to get rid of all the theaters they had around the country. Tastes were changing. People wanted real people in real situations, not these la-di-da type films that were geared to a lot of teenagers. And it was a whole different business then. There was a mystique also, an aura about the film industry that I don't believe there is today. Everything seems to be so very in your face. And they're not run by those incredible moguls like Jack Warner, Harry Cohn, you know, Daryl Zanuck, Louis B. Mayer. They ran a tight ship. They knew how they wanted their ship run.
What do you make of the fact that today that sort of the modern movie theater is dying and most people are watching films or TV shows on their computers?
Well, it's probably because they're not giving the product. You know, my mother was a very, very interesting woman, and she used to always say, elevate your thinking. And I don't think there's a lot out there elevating thinking. I do think there are some wonderful films that are made, but for every really good film, there's an awful lot of what I call, you know, money that's thrown away on a lot of dreck.
Now, of course, you know, with this movie and with this book, everyone is familiar with your story and what you know and what you were going through at the time, but can you take us back and sort of your decision process? How hard was it for you to sort of remain closeted to a certain extent in that era?
I just, you know, I always, I learned from my mother, you know, if there were negative things in your life, push them from your mind. So if there were people that were negative about me, or certainly about whether I gave a, you know, lousy performance in a film or this or that, or what kind of a human being I was, I just push things from my mind. People are always guilty of seeing what they want to see and being negative. And that's unfortunate, because there's so much positive out there if we just really stop to realize that. I was very shy, extremely shy. The work was a wonderful thing. Once I learned that this is something I really wanted to do, I was totally immersed in that. But every free moment, I was out at the barn with my horses. That was my touch of reality in that unrealistic world of Hollywood. And as far as my sexuality, I never discussed it with anyone. And if they discussed it with me, I probably would have freaked out, because it was none of their business.
But you know, and what does that say about the times today, where we seem to be so obsessed with the personal lives of celebrities to a certain extent?
Well, that's kind of unfortunate in a way. I mean, but you know, I was the same way as a kid. I loved movies. I went to them all the time. They were quite marvelous. You know, now I don't go at all. I wait for the Academy to send me the screeners so I can vote for the Academy Awards. But I just don't go out there. I don't want people getting up, you know, eating popcorn and, you know, talking loud like they're in their living room, or, you know, joking around. I concentrate on what's up on the screen, and that's why hopefully it's something good to concentrate on.
Now, from what I read, you were paired with Natalie Wood a few of the times, and I know you guys hung out a lot in the same circles. Talk about working with someone like her.
Well, Nat, I knew for a long time. I knew her as a little girl. She was one of my favorite people to work with. I mean, to me, Natalie was much younger than I, and I always looked at her like a kid sister. You know, she was like a young filly finding its legs. At one moment, she was a child, and the other moment she was a very lovely young lady. And it was wonderful watching that transition to her. At the time, I was at Warner Brothers with Natalie. She was going with Bob Wagner, and that was terrific. And we have RJ is in our documentary and talks. He never talks about Natalie, but he talks about her and our relationship. And I'm you know, he's a wonderful human being.
It seems
but
like
she was the best. She was the best.
And it was, I mean, what was, you know, it was really unfortunate what, you know, when that whole disappearance went down. Do you remember how you felt about it?
Oh, well, I knew right away. I always remember that she was scared to death of water. She had a fear of water. I remember when we did a film called The Burning Hills, I had to lift her onto the back of my horse and we were riding through the river, and she was so frightened, and I said, "Nah, just hang on real tight, you'll be fine. But she always had a fear of the water, and I do believe that probably that night she heard that boat hit, the little dinghy hitting against the side of the boat, and slipped on a jacket, a down parka, and went out on deck and slipped and fell and hit her head and fell in the water. That's my belief on what happened that night, because, and those down parkas are just filled up with water, they're very heavy, and that was it. It was very sad, very sad. She was a lovely young woman.
It seems like, at least the perception that I get, was that Hollywood was much more controlled back then, and what I mean by that is, you know, there were no agents, but, you know, the executives would control their actors' every move, you know, who they hung out with, where they went. Was that true, or is that a false presumption?
There's some degree of truth to that, and some degree there isn't. At Warner Brothers, I was very free to do what I wanted, as long as I was doing the job for them, and if I didn't do the job, I would be out and someone else would be in. Whereas, like at Paramount, I had a relationship with Tony Perkins. The studio told Tony not to see me. Well, now Warner's never ever said a word to me about, you know, who I should see or what here or there. They never said anything to me about that. They would say, "We have a young girl under contract. Would you take her to such and such a premiere? We'd like that. We'll cover that because we're trying to build her into a star," or this or that. And you did your job. And if you didn't do your job, you were out and someone else was in there. But they ran a very tight ship. Those moguls knew what they were doing. They were quite wonderful.
And I know you were sort of also, you know, at front and center of Hollywood during the McCarthy era. And just how does something like that affect you as an actor?
Well, I just think you have to see what's going on, and you have to be, you know, we all have our own beliefs, and that's what's important. It was very difficult, I'm sure, for a lot of wonderful actors and actresses. For example, Dalton Trumbo was a magnificent writer, but unfortunately he was, you know, branded and didn't work for years.
You know, and we've touched on your sexuality a little bit, but what do you make of the fact today that, A, it's a lot safer to be out in Hollywood in many respects, and just amongst the general population, gay rights has gained a lot more widespread acceptance, especially among young people.
Well, I think that's wonderful, but the unfortunate thing is, audiences will never sell. I don't think you can today have a gay person as a leading man or a leading woman. You have some that are characters, but you don't have the leading man or leading woman. And Portia de Rossi talks about that in our documentary, as well as Noah Wiley. It's a very difficult thing, so that's why there are a lot of people that just don't talk about their sexuality, whereas some people feel they must, and therefore they're very out there. It depends on the individual.
I think in terms of acceptance of maybe gay actors playing straight people and, you know, leading men, I think one of the people that's really helped us in that regard is somebody like a Neil Patrick Harris.
Yes, but he doesn't play leading men. He plays character roles.
True.
And he's a comedian. But you know, so, and he's been very good. He's just such a talented man.
Yeah. And I want to ask you about working with one of my favorite directors, John Waters. What was that experience like? Because he is a who.
Well, John, I always always refer to John as your friendly undertaker with his little Adolf Manjou mustache. He was quite wonderful, and I say he's the one who revitalized my career. When I was out on the dinner theater circuit, he called me to do the film with Divine, which was wonderful. There have been some incredible directors that I have worked with in motion pictures, and John is one of the great characters, and I love working for him because he does his own thing, and you have to respect him for that. He's very tasteful as a director. He's very good. When I say tasteful, I have to think about that for a moment. No, what he does, he has a really terrific knowledge of the direction he's going with this film.
You mentioned sort of at the top that you don't, you know, you don't like being in the public eye and you're sort of happily retired, but that you also enjoyed sort of doing what you did, being the actor, being the singer. Why did you decide to sort of walk away when you did?
Well, you know, your own, the industry was changing tremendously. And there weren't roles for me, and I wanted to leave I bought on my Warner Brothers contract because I wanted to be able to make my own choices of things to do. The studios were in a terrible state. They didn't know what they were going to be doing next because television has come in a huge way, and my best work was in live television, and I wanted to explore other areas, so that's one of the reasons. But I made some wrong choices there. It was a big mistake leaving the security of the studio, but they weren't giving you the opportunities. I went to Europe and did quite a few spaghetti westerns that I always say were a little light on the meat sauce. And, then I came back and was one of the pioneers of dinner theater. And then, thank God, John Waters called me up and offered me a fun role with Divine in Polyester.
Do you think if John Waters called you again, you would take it?
Well, I love John. I'd do anything for John. But the thing is, I don't see myself as an actor today. I have my horses that I've been around for years, and they're a very important part of my life. I feel closest to God with the pitchfork full of you-know-what in my hands. They're very important to me. I've been in that hoopla, surrounded by that, and it's not my comfort zone, but yet the work itself is really, really gratifying and rewarding if you have good material and lovely people to work with.
You know, actors always have other interests and other hobbies. What is it about horses for you that gives you that joy?
Well, I'll tell you, you're working with an animal that has a life of its own. I competed for years and years with hunters and jumpers. In fact, that's how I got my name, Hunter, because they said, we've got he rides hunters and jumpers. It could have been Tab Jumper for all I know. I think that they were my touch of reality in that really unrealistic world. I was around them as a stable boy. That's where I was discovered. And to this day, after we hang up, I'm going to be heading out to see my mare and her new foal out over in the valley. I mean, I find it very rewarding, and I find it's a very spiritual experience for me.
I want to touch on briefly on something you said about, how you became Tab Hunter. It seemed like everyone in those days had some sort of name that was created in many ways by the studios. Why do you think that was?
Well, it's not by the studios, by the agents, or their representatives. I just think they thought of commercial names, Guy Madison, Rock Hudson, Lana Turner, Linda Darnell, Piper Laurie, Tony Curtis. Yeah, I was one of them. I don't know why they did that. Somehow they probably thought that Malkovich or something like that on the screen would not be as saleable. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you can have a very weird name, and it'll be up there on the marquee.
And what do you make of the fact now that Hollywood is much more diverse than it used to be? We have, we see a lot more Asian and African American leading men. We see a lot more women now getting good roles. What's your take on that?
Well, there have been some very good women's roles in the past. Look at Barbara Stanwyck. Right. Films. Look at, come on. There were some great women's roles. Marlena Dietrich, come on. But I think it's fine. I think it's wonderful. They should do that. It should be very diverse, but also it should be intelligent. where we should go. It's all about material, material, and serial. Let's elevate our thinking.
I'm always critical of the summer season because it doesn't feel like there's a lot of intelligent films being released. It's all superheroes and Michael Bay to a certain extent.
Well, there's a $189 million film in Tomorrowland, and I understand it grossed $42 million in the first week it came. I mean, you know, they're shooting for the big shots. Give me those little lovely films that I love. Those small films that just have some meaning and some depth, and that are moving and that can elevate your thinking. I think that those are quite wonderful, and I'm thrilled when I see films like that. And you know, the good ones that come out. But Hollywood, there are a lot of people look at the rewards, and as opposed to look at, you know, what you can develop, how you can develop mentally, physically, and spiritually.
Yeah.
You know, through these films.
Is there a, you know, in sort of all the projects that you've done over the years, is there one that sticks out for you as a favorite in some regard?
Well, I like different projects for different reasons. I love Damn Yankees because it was my first musical. I worked with the whole Broadway, the complete Broadway cast. I love That Kind of Woman with Sophia Loren because it was another chance to work for Sidney Lumet, who was one of my favorite directors. Live television, the days of live TV were brilliant. I love that. Portrait of a Murderer, working with Geraldine Page. I mean, my gosh, you can't get any finer. Or directors like Arthur Penn and Sidney Lumet and John Frankenheimer, or Lucchino Visconti in Italy. I mean, those are wonderful, wonderful contributors. And I think it's all about hanging on to the coattails of the contributors and learning something, if you're willing, if you're lucky enough.
Well, the film is Tab Hunter Confidential. Tab Hunter, I can't thank you enough for being here today. It's been a real honor, and best of luck in seeing the movie out there, and have fun with the horses.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm thrilled at the reception of the documentary. I really am, and I'm very pleased to the way it's all moving, and I just want everyone to know that.
Hey, well, and thank you for taking some time to talk with us up in Canada.
Oh, I love it up there. I was just up in Toronto a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah, you were on CBC, right?
Yeah, we had a screening up there, and it was just incredible. Yeah. I was very, very impressed. Lovely audience. Yeah. Wonderful reception.
Well, hopefully we'll get an official here screening soon.
Hope so.
Alrighty, well, thank you for your time, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, same to you.
Alrighty, ciao. That about does it for the show this week. My thanks to Tab Hunter. The new movie is Tab Hunter Confidential. Also to economist Jeff Rubin, whose book is The Carbon Bubble, What Happens to Us When It Bursts. And also my thanks to Jasmine White-Galoose of No Joy. We're going to take you out with a final song off of their album More Faithful. This is Remember Nothing. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye.